When the Braves came to Milwaukee in 1953, it was called a miracle, and within 5 years, they'd won the World Series and two pennants. But you know what? By about 1964 or so, or 65, I guess, they had moved on to Atlanta and became the Atlanta Braves. And we're going to talk with our guest today about how it all happened. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Patrick Steele, he's in the studio with me. It's great to have him here. Associate Professor of History at Concordia University here in Wisconsin. He's a member of the Milwaukee Braves Historical Association. And his new book is called Home of the Braves, The Battle for Baseball in Milwaukee. Maybe you remember when the Braves came to Milwaukee. What was it like? Are you still upset about the move to Atlanta? What do you think led to that move? Well, I hope you'll join in our conversation. I think we have some answers for you today. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Certainly would love to hear from you. And Patrick Steele, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much for the invite. I appreciate being here.
I really enjoyed the book. You know, and here you are, a member of the Milwaukee Braves Historical Association. Of course, you're a historian, but it's amazing that a team that has been was only in the state for about 11 years, over 50 years ago, has an organization like that. To me, what is it about the Braves that still draws people?
Well, the 12 years they were here, it was a magical connection with the fans for most of it. And there certainly is a legacy to that organization. If you watch a Brewers game today, you'll see people wearing Milwaukee Braves caps. It's amazing that that story was there. And I think because of the attendance, the newness of County Stadium, the success, winning a World Series, beating the Yankees, certainly that was big. Hall of Fame players like Warren Spahn, all-time winningest left-hand pitcher. Henry Aaron on the front end of his, you know, an impressive home run career. Eddie Matthews, just a stalwart at third base.
Red Shandy's.
Absolutely, you know, still alive. You know, it is amazing how their story still remains. And there was a lot of fans who were very, very hurt by them leaving. And they remember the team. They remember the players with really heavy hearts, the fact that the team did leave and took their heart and soul with them.
Yeah, and for sure. And I tell you, I really enjoyed your book. I'll say that again. And I learned a whole lot in the book about things that I didn't know about. And one of the things we'll get to is to the idea that it was actually the Milwaukee Braves that probably were the starting point for a lot of the moves by a lot of the teams to other places. I want to get to that. But what was baseball like in the early 50s? I mean, life kind of revolved around baseball for a lot of people.
Well, late 40s, early 50s, you know, it was kind of that golden age of baseball, you know, the era of Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, the Brooklyn Dodgers, Jackie Robinson. It was a great time if you lived in the East Coast because you had a lot of baseball to see. If you lived anywhere else, not so much. But it was really hard for those second-tier franchises like the Boston Braves, the Philadelphia Athletics, the St. Louis Browns that just didn't have the same level of loyalty or attendance that some of the other major clubs did. But baseball was king. Football was a distant second. Basketball was farther down the list. Baseball was the be-all and end-all, and there were very few franchises.
And what were the players like? The players of that era are pretty different from the ones we have today in many ways.
Well, I think part of the primary reason is the income. The income level that a lot of these players made wasn't exorbitantly higher than what most people made. So it was quite often that they had jobs, you know, outside of what they did for baseball. So you play baseball from spring training to October, and the rest of the year you work at a hardware store, you're selling insurance, you're doing those things, and you're living in the neighborhood. You know, the great biography by Bob Beege of Eddie Matthews, you know, he talks about you know, how Matthews liked to cut his lawn and the kids would come over there and do it, and he just kind of missed that. But, you know, they were part of the community, and there wasn't that financial separation that you have today.
Yeah, you talk about, you know, somebody's kid might be babysitting Joe Adcock's kids or things of that nature. I mean, they really were a part of the community.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that was one of the best parts about the Braves story is how quickly they became ingrained, you know, in southeastern Wisconsin, you know, not just Milwaukee, you know, but the entire region.
So what persuaded Boston Braves owner was Lou Perini. What persuaded him to move his club?
Catastrophic attendance in Boston. It plummeted down. I mean, their last year there, they drew over 280,000 for an entire season. I mean, it was catastrophic. You know, we talk about a bad season to, you know, this year, I think the worst drawing team last year drew about 1.5 million. You know, that would be a dream season for most teams back in the day. But for the Boston Braves, I mean, they saw their attendance plummet from about 1.5 million in 1948 down to 280,000. The advantage of staying in Boston was Perini was a Boston guy. He owned his own stadium. They were looking at doing some renovations there. But the attendance just wasn't there. The loyalty to the organization wasn't there. And it became financially unviable for the team to remain in Boston.
And so he looked to Milwaukee for, and the county board over there, which I would say was a good relationship at first and not so good later on. But how did it get engineered?
Well, I mean, the biggest story was building the stadium before the Braves even came. And part of that background story is Lou Perini buying the minor league Milwaukee Brewers. So he owned Borchardt Field. He owned the rights to the city. So that was step number one. And then the next big step was probably Fred Miller with the pursuit of building not just County Stadium, but the Milwaukee Arena. He was just a phenomenal sportsman in Wisconsin and really was the driving force behind building County Stadium. And then once County Stadium was built, then it was, let's get a team in here before we make it a minor league stadium. And so he was really aggressive in going out and looking at it. And because Miller had really good relations with Perini, it made logical sense. If your attendance is that low in Boston, come here. But Miller had actually tried to buy the St. Louis Cardinals first.
And we're talking Miller as in Miller Brewing.
Absolutely. Fred Miller was the president of Miller Brewing. And he tried to buy the St. Louis Cardinals, and the fear that a potential rival was going to buy him caused Augie Bush to really step up and keep the Cardinals there. The next move was Bill Veeck, who had a long history with baseball in Chicago and Milwaukee, wanted to bring the St. Louis Browns back to Milwaukee. And Perini had the rights, would not have let anybody else come in. Behind the scenes, he worked a little bit with the county to get some improvements immediately for County Stadium if he brought the Braves here.
Yeah. Stephen Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to comment that I grew up in Racine in the 50s, and my dad used to take us up to County Stadium to see the Braves, and I could still tell you each player at each base for the 57 and 58 Braves. But we used to always go up. My dad would take us up early, in real early in the day, and I was probably about 8 or 9 years old in those days, and we would be there when the players came in to the stadium, and they'd drive up and just walk into the stadium, and there'd be maybe a dozen boys or kids out there, and they would sign autographs for us, sign baseballs, and it was just a real thrill for a young lad to get that close to their heroes.
Yeah, I have a good friend who told me about he taking the train. You could take the train from he was up in the Green Bay area, I believe, and they would take the train to Milwaukee. And the train would be full of Milwaukee Braves fans, and the train would take them back after the game was over.
Well, there was a lot of public transportation that took people out to the stadium, but the advantage County Stadium had really was the cars and the parking lots, and
yeah,
that's really what kind of triggered some of the other moves in baseball. Mm-hmm. But it was phenomenal, the amount of parking they had at a place like County Stadium versus Ebbets Field or even Yankee Stadium.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Steve. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go for Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I'm surprised with all the teams moving from place to place because they don't have the stadium or they want this or that. Since it's been happening for decades, I'm surprised there aren't more cases like the Green Bay Packers, where there's a group of local investors who just have a team that stays.
Well, the Braves actually tried that. They did sell stock, and one of the ways they tried to sell stock was they put Vince Lombardi on the board of directors. When the team made the decision to move, they kind of quietly fired Lombardi and all the other Wisconsin connections to the board. But in most cases now, they don't want that type of ownership, and the Packers have kind of an exception in the NFL. But if you wanted to start a new franchise now with that same type of ownership, the NFL would not approve it.
Yeah, or baseball wouldn't approve it either.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the different dynamic is, you know, you've heard it said a lot of times, you know, if you build it, they will come. The flip side of that is if you don't build it, they will leave.
Yeah, yeah, there we go. Thank you, Dennis, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Well, you know, and there was an interesting, I thought it was really interesting, the relationship between the county and the Braves when they first came, because the county rented the stadium to the Braves, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And it was for $1,000 or something.
Yeah, it was really actually cheap. And the Braves actually themselves offered to pay more, and they upped their own rental payments to the county because Perini really did not expect the type of response that he got. I mean, you're going from $280,000 to almost, you know, I think it was $1.5 million that first year in Milwaukee. That was a phenomenal improvement. The problem came in 1957, where the county looked at this publicly built asset and said, okay, well, now we get our money from it.
Yeah, and it was, and they were drawing at upwards of 2 million people.
Yeah, they were the outside of New York, they were the first team, I think, to hit the 2 million mark, and they did it consistently for a couple of years. But then success, kind of leads to when the team was not as good on the backside of that. You know, it's harder to maintain an attendance if you go from first to third as opposed to going from fifth to third.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Bill in Wisconsin Rapids?
Hi. I think that's me.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh. I'm originally from Hartford, and, I'm 75. I can remember going to the All-Star game in Milwaukee. But, Mike, I have a question for this gentleman. Lou Rudette, I believe, was the only pitcher that won three games.
And isn't in the Hall of Fame. And you know what? We'll have an answer for that right after we take a look at the news. Stay with us. When the Boston Braves relocated to Milwaukee in the early 50s, the city and state welcomed them with open arms. That all changed in about a decade's time. And they moved to Atlanta. Larry Mueller here with my guest Patrick Steele, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University here in Wisconsin, a member of the Milwaukee Braves Historical Association. His new book is called Home of the Braves, The Battle for Baseball in Milwaukee. How do you feel about that move? What do you think could have been done to keep the Braves in Milwaukee? Or was there anything that could have been done? Or maybe is it better that they were gone and we've got the Brewers now? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. You know, Bill in Wisconsin Dells had a question about Lou Burdett. Lou Burdett won three games in that World Series when the Braves won the World Series and beat the Yankees. And he was a great pitcher, but he's not in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, his window of greatness was relatively small in comparison to some of the other pitchers, and there's so many pitchers out there that have, you know, a phenomenal resume. But, you know, Lou Burdett is an iconic figure in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. He is the reason that we can say, you know, Milwaukee has won a World Series. Our franchise now hasn't, but our city, our state has. And, you know, I think he pitched the last game on 2 days rest. It was a phenomenal story because, you know, the guy that's in the Hall of Fame and won all the games, Warren Spahn, he only won a single game in that World Series.
Yeah, interesting. I was thinking about the pitchers at that time. There was a game, Spahn pitched, I think, 15 innings in a game out in San Francisco.
Yeah, against Juan Marichal.
Unbelievable that those guys could do it. Marichal was right there with them bitching the whole
time. Well, Marichal was younger. You know, Spahny was in his 40s. That's the amazing story.
Yeah. Bill in Ashland, thanks for calling.
Good morning, Larry, to you and your guest. I wanted to just briefly discuss the political and cultural scene in Milwaukee in 1953 when the Braves came to town. Sometime in 1910, the Democrat Party was banned from the city of Milwaukee due to corruption. That was the Rose administration, I believe. And the Democrat Party was not allowed in the city of Milwaukee until 1960. So it was the Milwaukee so-called sewer socialists who were the ones that were responsible for the inviting the team to Milwaukee, and also the ones that built the county stadium and these other civic projects. And I would just like to say that basically the Democrat Party took such a hard turn to the left in 1968 in Chicago that this kind of culture in Milwaukee that was based primarily on the working class ethics has been almost completely destroyed in this country. And that's where so many of our problems come now with this kind of identity politics.
Hmm. Well, you know, the city of Milwaukee obviously had a huge influence on the whole bringing of the Braves to Milwaukee, did they not?
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
the mayor at the time was a socialist.
Frank Zeidler, and he was instrumental. But you know, it was the county more than the city that you know fought to get the stadium there. And you know, maybe you know one of the best lessons learned in all of this was when they built Miller Park. They put a 5-county region together to help run the stadium and finance it. And you know, as I live in one of those 5 counties. It hurts every time I have to go pay something because I pay a little bit extra percentage in tax. But the positive side is it's not just a single county board that controls our baseball fate in, you know, in Milwaukee the way it did back in in the 1960s.
Yeah, and the 1950s. And it was such a time. I mean, people just went crazy for the Braves. You've got a great story in there. I think it was Eddie Matthews talking about how every time a pitcher won a game, they got a case of beer, Miller beer, and the players, I think they were renting an apartment or something. They had to rent an extra room to hold all the beer because they were getting cases of beer from everybody.
Yeah, well, Milwaukee was still, you know, the beer capital of the world at the time, you know, at least of the United States. And you had all these, separate breweries. You had Blatt's, you had Pabst, you had Miller, Gettleman. All those breweries were still in Milwaukee. And everybody wanted to be part of it. It was a civic religion almost to be part of the Braves, you know, fan club, to be part of what was going on at County Stadium. You know, one of your earlier callers mentioned coming up from Racine. There's a story where, you know, two guys got on a bike, and I have in the book, you know, they rode their bike up to get in line to buy tickets. It was an amazing thing to see, and to look back at it, I can't imagine what it would have been like to stand in line like that just to wait to buy tickets for the next homestand.
Yeah, unbelievable. Well, Steve in Burlington, your turn now. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. As I said to your screener, what was kind of interesting about my situation is I grew up in Lake Geneva, and we could get Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison on a good day with an aerial as far as TV. And as a 9-year-old, when the Braves left to go to Atlanta, that just didn't register with me at all. I mean, I was so angry. And one of the things that we had then was Channel 9, which was, you know, carrying the Cubs.
WGN. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think in those days they shared like they do today, you know, a little bit with the Cubs and the Sox. And the other factor was the UHF channels. There was a channel 32 and then later on 44, and those also covered the Sox. And, you know, coupled with being frustrated as a 9-year-old and wanting to watch baseball, it's what kind of made a lot of us, and you still see it in Kenosha, you still see a lot of Cub fans in Kenosha, and I bet a lot of those people, it's because they could get a clear signal on WGN, and it gave them something to watch. And it was hard. You know, I mean, we had all the Eddie Matthews and Henry Aaron, the uniforms, and even in those days they had, like, miniature, not bobbleheads, but although there were some bobbleheads around them, but a lot of the, they had a name for them. We'd get the miniatures, and the miniature baseball bats were a big thing with the players' names on them, which I think they still sell, but
yeah.
It was difficult from what I can recollect about being 9 years old.
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling. That. Talk about that a little bit, Patrick.
Well, you know, television was certainly a major point in the Boston Braves' failure. And it was one of the reasons why when the team came, Lou Perini did as much as he could to keep the Braves off the air in southeastern Wisconsin. So outside of a World Series game or an All-Star game, you really did not get to see the Braves much at all until 64, because the county was always afraid they were going to lose revenue as well, so they didn't want games televised. Nobody really understood how television was changing and moving forward. You know, and you mentioned, too, you know, what being able to watch the Cubs. You know, a couple of the county executives made that, or county supervisors, rather, made that point. One of them was Eugene Grobschmidt, who, you know, had kind of said in the testimony, look, you know, if I want baseball, you know, all I got to do is turn my television on, I can watch the Cubs, yeah. Which is not what you want to say when you're trying to keep the Braves here.
No, no, for sure. Steve, thank you so much. Louise in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Louise.
Hi there. Say, I grew up in Boston, and I remember as a young child going to Braves Stadium and watching them. And when they left, at least our family, and of course that was, you know, the world, it was such a, you know, it was really devastating to have them leave Boston. But going to Milwaukee, at least it was the Midwest. I have family in the Midwest. My grandpa could listen to the radio there, and we kind of basked in reflected glory when they won the World Championship, especially over the Yankees, you know. So anyway, that was my connection with it, and I was disappointed when they left Milwaukee because, again, Midwest, Boston, yeah. there was a heart line that was drawn there, so...
Oh, Louise, thank you so much. Comment?
Yeah, there was a lot of fans that still followed the team when they came. And, you know, certainly there was a warning, you know, that came out of Boston as well that, you know, if a city like Milwaukee could lure a team like the Braves, you know, you better be really good or somebody else might do the same thing to you. And, you know, it's actually kind of funny because, you know, when the Braves came, despite the success they had, there were always persistent rumors that the team was going to move somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
Always, yeah. Thank you again, Louise, for calling. Appreciate your call. And, well, let's go to Larry in Racine. Larry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, great show. I grew up with the Braves, and when they left Milwaukee, it devastated me to the point where I didn't even follow baseball for 30 years. And I have a short story to tell. We went to a lot of Braves games, and Joe Torre was warming up the pitcher on the first baseline.
Yep.
And they were about to start the game, and so Joe Torre walked over to the stands and he threw the ball up, and my brother was kind of timid. Chad came and grabbed the ball for my brother, and Joe Torre walked over there, pointed at the kid, and said, "I threw the ball to him." And the kid went, "Whoa," and he gave the ball right to my brother. And I was a lifetime fan of Joe Torre.
and with good reason.
Yeah, Torre was a great representative of the club, you know, as a whole. You know, kind of that second generation of Milwaukee Braves, you know, came in, his older brother played first base. Joe Torre was just a stalwart, you know, into the 60s.
Yeah, thanks so much, Larry, for that story. Appreciate your call. Oh, heck, Ray and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Ray.
Hi, wonderful show. I grew up in Milwaukee on the north side, and Hank Aaron, a bunch of them, you know, lived around the area, and my father knew them very well. It was quite a time. You know, baseball was at its peak. We had one of the finest teams in the United States, and they were all approachable back then. Like nowadays, you can't get near anybody unless you have these passes and go through all this stuff. Back then, you could just walk up to somebody there, and if they were available, they would talk to you, and you could get interviews. I have over 123 memorabilia types of things that are signed, baseballs, hats, just everything by all the team members, and I'm just wondering what that stuff would be worth.
Yeah, you'd have to look at it, you know, an expert for that. You know, memorabilia is one of those that, you know, it's hard to tell unless you actually saw somebody sign it yourself. You're putting a lot of trust in what that is. And obviously for you, you saw it. But for somebody buying it, they got to know for sure. That becomes problematic. But, you know, sometimes the players, you know, really aren't that much different in approachability. My wife and I took my kids and my granddaughter down to Atlanta to catch a Milwaukee Brewers game down there. And my granddaughter at the time was about a year and a half. And we stood down on the side that the Brewers were at, and a bunch of them came up, including Ryan Braun, and signed a baseball for her. So she got four baseballs that day.
Huh.
My entire life, I'd never gotten one, and she got four that first time there.
Oh, my goodness. That was a great story. Ray, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rosie and Ashland, your turn. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. My memories are actually of the Denver Bears because I grew up in Denver and my dad was a fan. And that Hank and Tommy Aaron were both players on the Bears team before they went to the Braves, because the Bears were the farm team, I believe, for the Braves.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a lot of farm teams. I mean, the number of minor league baseball teams, you know, into the 50s is mind-boggling today to think of how many teams were actually out there. And that was one of the things that television probably did, was it, you know, really, you know, devastated the smaller minor league, you know, towns. I mean, maybe one of the neat things about it today is, I know in Madison you have, you know, the Wood Bat League. I think it's the Mallards.
The Mallards.
Yeah.
Very well-attended games. I've been to many of them.
Yeah, and on our campus, we have Capco Park, and we host the Lakeshore Chinooks. So my campus university, you know, we're very closely connected to that Wood Bat League, too.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Thank you, Rosie, for calling. Appreciate your call. One of the things, and Tom, we'll get to you in just a second. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. The whole story about beer was interesting to me because early on, you could bring your own beer to the game and take it right in the game with you.
Oh, absolutely. There was no restrictions on it. And in Milwaukee, a lot of the breweries gave their employees free beer. So, you know, you could bring a keg in. People are bringing, you know, a full case of, you know, bottled beer or canned beer, you know, into the stadium. And, you know, the county didn't really like it, but they didn't want to prohibit it. The Braves, of course, didn't like it because they weren't getting any of the revenue. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of the Milwaukee fans, you know, our reputation was frugal, didn't realize that in other stadiums you couldn't do that. But my favorite story, and I included it in the book, was the St. Louis fans that came in. They brought a garbage bag full of ice and Budweiser, and they were selling it to fans in the stadium during a Cardinals series, you know, at County Stadium until they got chased away by local authorities. But, you know, the beer ban was a huge issue when it came into place in 61. And there was some level of fan boycott because they didn't want to have to pay the county's prices, which were relatively cheap compared to what a beer costs now. In, you know,
31 cents a bottle, I believe you pointed out.
Yeah, and even when you rate that out for inflation, it was still relatively cheap. But they just didn't want to do it, and then the county rescinded it the following year. And then when the Braves made it clear they were going to leave, you know, and a little bit of vengeance, the county put it back in place for 65.
Yeah. Now we'll go to Tom in Rhinelander. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I always love your show. I'm calling about a story that I heard about the early Braves in Milwaukee, and I don't know if it's true or if it was just a myth, but the story was that they had a pitcher who only pitched for a short time and lost his contract because he had a drinking problem and actually showed up drunk for one of the games. His name was supposed to have been Melvin Famey, and the story is that he was intoxicated enough that he walked most of the other team's players, and they won almost all on walks. And as the other team was walking off the field, they saw a case of Blatt's, and the catcher said, "What's that?" And the pitcher said, "That's the beer that made Mel Famey walk us."
Well, you know, stories like that, you know, about the players and the on-the-field stuff, you know, Bob Beege, who wrote the foreword to my book, wrote a book called The Milwaukee Braves, A Baseball Eulogy, and he's got a lot of those types of stories in there. And, you know, that book is still available, too, and I'd encourage you to take a look for it. But, yeah, there's some legendary stories about the players. You know, one of the players they had, you know, liked the Polish sausage a little bit too much and put on quite a bit of weight, and they had to move him out fairly quickly too. So
there we go. Tom, thank you. Gene in Portage, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I grew up in Milwaukee, of course. I was 9 to 10 years old, and we would ride our bicycles to the stadium because they were in the process of building the expressways in Milwaukee. So we could hop on our bikes. There was no traffic, of course, just these ribbons of concrete that took us all the way down to National Avenue, and then we proceeded to the stadium. Our neighbor worked at the Veterans Administration, and the veterans had a block of seats just beyond first base. So about noon for the afternoon games, if all the veteran seats weren't taken, doctor next door would call home, tell his wife how many tickets the kids could have, and four, five, six of us would jump on our bikes and get there just in time for the first pitch.
Well, you know, the neat story about that, too, is when County Stadium was first built, it was actually built on federal land, and it took a signature from President Truman to clear it for the county to actually go in there and build it. And one of the conditions was that and they used to call it the old soldiers' home, but that the veterans that were there would have access at least to see the game. So in the early years of County Stadium before the expansion, they used to put a block of bleachers on the hill that overlooked the outfield, you know, fence, and that's what they did. Well, what happened is as attendance kept growing, they kept expanding the stadium, that blocked the view. So eventually they started doing the seats inside the stadium.
Oh, interesting. Thank you so much, Gene, for calling. Rick in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hey, guys. I've got a story of how simple those players were back in those days. When I was a kid, I lived in the suburbs in Wauwatosa, and we live in a two-flat at 116th and Cherry. Next door to me was Del Crandall living in a two-flat, and that became kind of a magical time for me because my family became friends with Del. And I went to a lot of different games with Del's tickets. And one time, Del took my dad and me to the stadium, took me into the clubhouse as the players were getting dressed. And he said to me, take your mitt and go over. And he pointed to a young black man getting dressed for the game. And he says, get that guy to sign that mitt for you. And I did. And that was Hank Aaron. Subsequently, of course, I played ball with that mitt for the rest of my youth. And so... anyway, we became friends with Del. I spoke with Del probably a couple years ago. He's back in Los Angeles taking care of Fran, his wife. And I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he became, of course, the manager of the of Brewers. And I was attending school up in Appleton at Lawrence. And when Del was named manager, I had a little sports radio show on the local radio there for WLFM in Appleton. And none of the... the big media people could get a hold of Del. I called my mom and got Del's number and called him, and I interviewed Del that day when he was named manager. So,
great story.
That is a really great story. And yeah, Del is still alive. You know, and he was, of course, the catcher on opening day in 1953, and he and Sponnie were there for the last game at County Stadium, and they, you know, threw out the last ceremonial first pitch. So there's a kind of a little bit of symmetry there to County Stadium with Del Crandall.
Well, this is so much fun. Somebody wondered if Lou Burdette actually threw spitballs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, off the record, he would probably not admit that. But, you know, the best part about it was when you had a reputation of being a spitball pitcher, anything you did just got in the head of the other team. So he'd fidget out there once in a while just to get in, you know, under their skin.
Well, so we have not covered anywhere close to... what we could have, that what you've got in your book, Patrick, and it's really, really a fun, must have been fun to write.
You know, it was a labor of love, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, the hardest part is, you know, it's a book about the Braves, but it's not about baseball on the field. Yeah. And so, you know, going through the articles, I'm like skimming through things that, you know, are talking about, you know, on base percentage or, you know, batting averages to really find what I was looking for, because I really wanted to answer that question, why they failed in Milwaukee. And they did fail in Milwaukee because they're not there anymore.
Yeah. They're not there anymore. And you go into a lot of detail on it. And I have to say, I really enjoyed reading your book. I hope it sells well.
Oh, I hope so, too.
I bet you do. Patrick Steele, our guest today, and his book is called Home of the Braves, The Battle for Baseball in Milwaukee. I hope you have a chance to pick up a copy and read it. It's a fun read. And again, the author, Patrick Steele, my guest today. Just to look ahead, tomorrow we'll take a look at the first managed elk hunt in Wisconsin, the Urban Wildlife Project, and upcoming DNR public hearings. That's at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.